racist zero-sum narrative versus the solidarity dividend.
If enough white Americans put aside the zero-sum narrative and recognize their common problems with working and middle-class people of color, we could create a durable multiracial coalition to unlock what I began to call the solidarity dividend.
That's Heather McGee. We talk with her about her important new book, The Sum of Us. It's about how the politics of racial division keeps working-class people of all races from having what they deserve. But first, we talk with Michelle Commander of the Schomburg Center about the anthology she's co-edited, Unsung, Unheralded Narratives of American Slavery and Abolition. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice, in-depth conversation with writers of all genres, on the air since 2004. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm host and producer, Francesca Rhiannon. We've all heard of Frederick Douglass, but how about the great abolitionist David Walker? And how many of us have read accounts of slavery written by people who had been enslaved themselves? Now, the Schomburg Center for Research in Black Culture, a historic branch of the New York Public Library, has reached into its vast collection of slavery and anti-slavery narratives to bring together well-known documents by abolitionists along with lesser-known life stories and overlooked accounts of the everyday lives and activism of the slavery era. My guest, Michelle Commander, has written the introduction and co-edited the Unsung anthology with Kevin Young. She's associate director and curator of the Lapidus Center for Historical Analysis of Transatlantic Slavery, which is part of the Schomburg Center. Kevin Young is the director of the Smithsonian National Museum of African American History and Culture. Michelle Commander, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thanks for having me.
This wonderful collection of narratives, as you call them in the subtitle, Unheralded Narratives of American Slavery and Abolition, this collection, Unsung, I'm curious about the cover art of the book. Power concedes nothing without a demand. It's not the title of the book, is it?
No, it's not the title of the book, which might be slightly confusing, but I think it's a great talking point for folks who are checking the book out. I think that it really sticks out to you, right? This cover. This cover was conceived with the designer thinking about the kinds of broadsides or posters that were used during this time period to alert the public to a certain kind of event, including abolitionist meetings, speeches that were going to be held and that kind of thing. And so these were often, I would say screen printed, but it may be the wrong technology, screen printed on the posters, which were usually a white or ivory kind of backgrounds with bold black lettering, kind of like the cover is here. And so what we decided to do was find a succinct saying from slavery that would really stick out to people and make people think about the stakes of the sort of abolitionist project. And so it turns out that the phrase that I had in mind that I really wanted to include was a little bit too long. So we ended up using a phrase, a very sort of common phrase from Frederick Douglass, if you're a historian or history buff, that we thought would share the stakes of the particular project and be very powerful. And of course, that image of those formerly enslaved people, these are people who are at a camp awaiting the end of the Civil War, really sort of drives home through how the people are looking at the camera. They're looking directly at the camera. Nobody's smiling, although people didn't tend to smile in pictures back then anyway. But they look very fierce and they look like they're people who know the stakes of fighting for their lives.
Yes. And for our radio audience, that picture of a group of recently liberated, right?
Yes.
People are in front of and behind the words, power concedes nothing without a demand. A phrase that I hear regularly alluded to. In fact, just the other day, I heard it. So Frederick Douglass is very much with us. I think until we have true social justice and equality and solidarity, that phrase will be a touchstone for us all.
Absolutely.
Now, in this collection, one of the early essays is by Black abolitionist David Walker. You say that his 1829 essay, Appeal to the Colored Citizens of the World, was perhaps the most radical anti-slavery document ever published in the United States. That's quite a claim. So tell us why.
Well, I often sort of giggle to myself when I just look at the text of David Walker's appeal, not actually reading the words, but looking at the ways that he used punctuation and capitalized letters. He was very fiery in his delivery, right? You can almost hear somebody articulating the words. You know that if somebody writes you something with four exclamation points or it's in all letters, that they mean business. And David Walker was writing about the hypocrisy of white Christian slaveholders. He was talking about what it meant to be an American at that time and what it meant for folks to have full rights at that time in ways that were very direct and very rare for the abolitionists of that time period. So you could see in his text how he, in some ways, caused Black abolitionists as well as white abolitionists to be a little bit wary of him and a little bit afraid that he was being direct in a way that may turn off people who could actually cause who could actually affect change and cause slavery to end more quickly. So one of the things that David Walker says within this appeal is something like this, and I'm going to paraphrase again. So he says, America is more the Blacks than the whites. This country belongs more to the Black people than the white people, is what he's saying. And he goes on to say, we have enriched the soil with our blood and tears. So what David Walker is talking about at that point of the appeal is this idea that was really becoming fashionable that free Black people ought to go back to Africa. They were seen as troublemakers. They were seen as people who were causing enslaved people to rebel and resist in ways they hadn't done before. And that if they could only get rid of those pesky Black abolitionists or Black free people, that somehow they could carry on with the institution of slavery. And he pushes against that. He pushes against the Black abolitionists who believe that going back to Africa may be the best thing for their future. And so it's very fiery. It's a very Black nationalist statement before we're talking about Black nationhood or bettering the Black community in the ways that David Walker is talking about. David Walker believes that there should be full equality, that Black people should have the rights that are afforded to everybody else in this nation. And again, it was very fiery. It went against the ways that abolitionists were carrying themselves at the time. It was too pointed. And the thought is that David Walker was poisoned and killed, although there is still some question about how it is that he passed away.
Really? Yes. Say more about that.
There's not very much more to say other than the fact that this man passes away suddenly and no one really understands it. And what people are able to think is that, well, you know, the appeal is one that actually was printed and reprinted all across the country. So while there were some abolitionists who may have been a little bit more conservative minded, there were also people who were eating it up. Right, there's stories about David Walker's appeal being sewn into clothing that was meant for slaves in the South, that people were found with it. Fugitives from slavery were found with it in their pockets. So it's not far-fetched to think that someone would want to kill him because he was inspiring a new kind of abolitionist-minded individual because of the ways that he was able to articulate his distaste of slavery, that he was able to break down exactly why it was these Christians were hypocrites, that he was able to use evidences that people hadn't necessarily put together in one document to show why slavery was wrong.
You know, it struck me in reading his piece that he's calling for recognition of the humanity of black slaves in America. It very much like the slogan I remember in the 1960s, I am a man, I am a human being. And I couldn't help but reflect that so much of what David Walker talks about is just as alive and problematic today. I mean, the dehumanization of black people, systemic and systematic expropriation, which he talks about. He talks about, you know, a man will work hard to buy some land and erect a little house, and, you know, within 9 months, he's driven off from it. I mean, that's something that happened to Malcolm X's family and his father, and something we saw during the subprime mortgage crisis, basically. I mean, the wholesale expropriation of black property.
Yeah. It's one of those things that made me feel good to be able to include in this text. And there's some other examples of it in Unsung as well. But it's also disheartening. And it makes you really consider what it is we mean when we talk about American progress and American equality. I hope that readers are able to make these connections, right? To see that people aren't playing a race card, right? We're not just bringing up race because it's fun, but because we are aware, many of us are aware of the ways that slavery is the root, right? That there are legacies to that kind of institution, that the sentiment about the inferiority of African people did not somehow just go away when slavery ended in this country. In fact, we have new forms, right, of injustice that have occurred, and we can just start rattling them off, right? But I hope that people are able to take these texts, that they're able to see the humanity of Black people, that they're able to see the strategies employed by abolitionists, whether they were free Black people, enslaved Black people, white people, whoever they were, all these people from different came together in order to eradicate this horrific institution.
This is Writer's Voice, and I'm Francesca Rhiannon. We're talking with Michelle Commander of the Schomburg Center about the anthology she's co-edited, Unsung, Unheralded Narratives of American Slavery and Abolition. Yeah, I mean, I found throughout the connections with today, you know, I was just reading in the news today about a school in California that was being renamed. It had been named Abraham Lincoln something, and it was being renamed as an effort to rename schools to recognize racial justice. And Abraham Lincoln was included in this because he wasn't as anti-slavery as his reputation would have us believe. Michelle Commander, in this anthology, Unsung, you have H. Ford Douglas's 1860 essay, I Do Not Believe in the Anti-Slavery of Abraham Lincoln. What were his critiques of Lincoln? You know, there were several, but let's say start with gradualism.
I would say that it was this idea of a more slow progress or slow change. For many free Black people, and of course enslaved people, the time probably seemed triple time, right? How they were experiencing the days of slavery. And for not only someone like Abraham Lincoln, but also for some white abolitionists, this idea of gradualism or a sort of slow change, they felt it was the best, right? That it would help bring everybody under the same umbrella if you don't make things happen too quickly. And so Abraham Lincoln was feeling that way. Abraham Lincoln also supported these return to Africa ideals, this idea that, you know, these free Black people, I don't know what to do with them, he says, I'm paraphrasing. So early on, before he's forged this kind of relationship, some people call it a friendship with Frederick Douglass, Abraham Lincoln is not as progressive, at least at first, as perhaps he ought to have been, right? So you have folks like H. Ford Douglass and others who call out Abraham Lincoln for not being where he should be as far as the anti-slavery cause went.
It reminds me again of attitudes today when people say, don't let the perfect be the enemy of the good, where that just means slowing down, addressing the urgent needs for systemic reform, systemic change.
Yeah, It's interesting how these kinds of histories repeat themselves, that people, human beings, haven't changed so much in this country, the ways that they think about change. And, you know, I think often about the ways, for instance, that enslaved people were punished, you know, if they ran away or attempted to run away, if they engaged in some sort of insurrection or plans for insurrection, the brutality, the barbarity that was witnessed firsthand by people in these towns and in these cities, people who read full accounts of newspapers about the punishments that were meted out to these enslaved people. And I'm talking about people who were decapitated, their heads were placed on stakes, down roads. And for people to still believe that slavery was an overall good, that it was somehow helping these so-called primitive Black people to come into modernity, whatever that meant back then, is amazing to me, and not in a good way. It's amazing to me that people could have thought that way back then. And then for us to see articulations or iterations of that today is just heartbreaking. It's heartrending. And so it's not surprising, right? So when we have today people who can see these iPhone recorded instances of police overreach or violence and murder, people who have not been tried in a court of law, you get a sense that people haven't changed so much. And slavery is one of the roots of that kind of sentiment, of that kind of dismissive philosophy, of these white supremacist kinds of notions.
Yeah, and I think that's very wise to point it back to slavery. You know, that's something that Frederick Douglass talked about. His essay in the book, The Mission of War, he's talking about the Civil War. He's saying very clearly the cause of war was slavery, just as I think, you know, the cause of what you've just talked about, the ills that we have today, is also found in slavery. I mean, it's not found in some kind of human nature of all ages. It's found in our institutions that have not yet dealt with it. So this is an amazing essay as well. Why did Frederick Douglass have to make clear that the cause of the war was slavery?
Because people were already mythologizing things about American progress and this idea of shame and how people were already starting to rewrite what the history actually was. In that piece, Frederick Douglass is also trying to call to arms free Black men into the war. And he wants to make it clear what the stakes are of the war. We need to go into this war. We know what it is. Do not fall for these ideas of it being a state's rights issue or something else. Keep in mind that the cause of it all, when it's all said and done, is slavery. These people in these particular states want to maintain the right, the state's right, to keep slaves, right? To line their pockets and use this free and abused labor force, right? To continue to line their pockets and to set their families financially free.
And he was asking for unity, not union. What's the distinction there?
That's a good question. I think for him, he's thinking about folks keeping their eyes on the prize and not necessarily just thinking about all the politics that were involved, but this idea of just, for the moment, let's come together, right? We can talk about these other quibbles that we have. Let's just come together to defeat this main issue. And then we can talk about what it means, right, to be one union, right? But we need to go forthrightly into the future. And right now it calls for us to just come together to defeat this common injustice that is happening in this land.
I'm going to read just the last few sentences of this essay, you know, to illustrate what you've just said. This is Frederick Douglass. He writes, "We now want a country in which the obligations of patriotism shall not conflict with fidelity to justice and liberty. We want a country and are fighting for a country which shall be free from sectional political parties, free from every kind and description of sect, party, and combination of a sectional character. We want a country where men may assemble from any part of it without prejudice to their interests or peril to their persons. And it seems to me that what he's asking for is a society of solidarity, justice, and truth.
Yes, absolutely. And he said it way better than I could. he has that way. That's why I included it. You know, when you think about someone like Frederick Douglass, he is probably the, you know, if people know something about slavery, he's in that top, you know, three people that they mention. And he had this way with words that could really stir the emotions of people and get people on board to affect change. And I think what you've read is just powerful and indicative of the kind of way that he was able to be such a powerful and important abolitionist for that time.
So as we're talking today, we're in the midst of the second impeachment trial of a president who's a white supremacist, who fomented insurrection to overturn an election in the dying days of his presidency. What lessons can Frederick Douglass give us as we consider this time of ours and a way forward to heal?
I think that someone like Frederick Douglass, along with, I'll just say, everyone who is an author who's an abolitionist mentioned in the text, demonstrate to us this commitment that we have, this charge that we have as human beings, as American citizens, to do the right thing. We don't have to sit back and think, oh, I don't have the talent to be a speechmaker, or I don't have the talent to be a person who writes editorials. These people thought creatively. When you think about this text, Unsung, we have folks who were abolitionists on the ground. There were enslaved people. So you think about people who can march, you know, you can march with your 2 feet, you can wheel your wheelchair. There are ways that you can be a part of the marches. You can make phone calls, you can knock on doors. Nearly everybody is able to make some sort of difference. When you look at the children's literature section, people who were talented in that way to speak to children about what it meant to be anti-slavery and they're thinking about this new generation. When you think about the poets who are included in this volume, the playwrights, it seems like there was a way that even back then, from the 1700s, where the book starts, all the way to the dawn of the 20th century, you have people who were able to find a way to make a difference. And I think that's something that we can take away from it, right? So while what happened in DC last month, this Capitol insurrection, was another blight on the United States and was scary and demoralizing and heartbreaking to see, I do think that a person like Frederick Douglass and his vision, as well as these other people who are unsung, really demonstrate to us that we have to keep our eye on the prize and that we are all responsible for making a better future.
Oh, that's such a beautiful way to end. It's just been a real privilege to talk with you, Michelle Commander, and to, you know, be exposed to these unsung voices in the anthology Unsung. Thank you so much for talking with us here.
Thank you so much. It's great to speak with you.
Michelle Commander is Associate Director and Curator of the Lapidus Center for Historical Analysis of Transatlantic Slavery. You can read an excerpt from Unsung by going to writersvoice.net. Next up, the zero-sum narrative versus the solidarity dividend. Stay tuned after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. President Lyndon Johnson famously said once, "If you can convince the lowest white man he's better than the best colored man, he won't notice you're picking his pocket. Hell, give him somebody to look down on, and he'll empty his pockets for you." Since the civil rights movement of the 1960s, a majority of white voters have chosen Republican candidates over Democrats. And since that time, middle and working class white folks have seen their incomes flat or declining, the decimation of the unions that had once protected their incomes, and the constant narrowing of access to public goods like education and health care. Is there a connection? You bet, says my guest, Heather McGee. Her new book, The Sum of Us, What Racism Costs Everyone and How We Can Prosper Together, shows how the racist zero-sum narrative has led to the impoverishment of middle and working class Americans of all races and ethnicities. And overturning that narrative will mean a new race-class narrative that builds solidarity for all. Heather McGee is an expert in economic and social policy, the former president of the inequality-focused think tank Demos. She now chairs the board of Color of Change, the nation's largest online racial justice organization. Well, Heather McGee, welcome to Writer's Voice. You start out this wonderfully powerful and comprehensive book by saying, "Why can't we have nice things?" What are the nice things you're talking about, and who is the we?
Well, the nice things are not flying cars like we're supposed to have, or laundry that does itself, which would be nice to have. But I really mean the nice things that a society of our wealth and development should have, like universal health care and modern world-class infrastructure and robust public health system to handle pandemics. And the we who doesn't have that those things is all Americans, both the white Americans, who are the largest group of the uninsured and the impoverished, and the people of color, who are disproportionately so.
Yeah, I think that so often, you know, gets elided. We talk about peoples of color, and it's true, who are the first and worst to lose access or to not have access to begin with, but that just by virtue of demographic numbers, there are more in numbers of white people who are poor. And I think that is really, you know, the center of the book is how racism has gotten in the way of all of us having nice things. Talk about, how does racism actually accelerate inequality for everybody?
You know, this was a new thought to me. I spent nearly 20 years working in economic and public policy, trying to research and advocate for solutions to economic inequality broadly, tax policy, labor policy, financial regulation, these kinds of topics. And I always thought about race. I'm a Black woman, so, you know, the impact on people of color and Black people particularly was very important to me. But I thought of it in the way that kind of the economic orthodoxy tells us to think about it, which is there are these economic issues over here. And then there's the way that discrimination and disadvantage sort of compound on top of those economic decisions to make outcomes worse for people of color. And when I left running a think tank, which I was doing for a number of years, to go on a journey across the country for almost 4 years to write the book, The Sum of Us, I was going in pursuit of the answer to that question about nice things, and also on a hunch about the way that racism actually is at its core exemplified by this zero-sum worldview that is very predominant among white Americans, less so among people of color. The idea that progress for people of color has to come at white people's expense. You know, every dollar in my pocket means a dollar less in yours. And at its core, that zero-sum racial hierarchy is what has left us as a country poorer, has left the white majority to sort of cheer economic policies that are kind of stingier and meaner and more cruel than would be in their self-interest, because there's a sense that it might be in the interest of people of color.
Yeah, and you go through in this book, The Sum of Us, you go through all the different ways in which that's true, in which that's happened. I mean, you refer back to, you know, the post-war rise of the middle class, and it very much was a rise of the white middle class, although there were gains for people of color as well, as the union movement came in and there were factory jobs, etc. But talk about, when did that begin to change? When did the prosperity of the middle class begin being chipped away, and the link of that to racial politics?
You know, I think everyone has a gut level sense that the American dream used to be easier to attain, that there was a time when it was just easier to have a decent standard of living. And of course, now we are 40 plus years into the inequality era. And, you know, even the right wing, you know, Donald Trump harkens back to it, right? When he talks about Make America Great Again, there's a lot there that's explicitly about race and explicitly about that zero sum, but it's also about a common sense that the middle class used to be more robust and that it used to be easier to get into it and stay into it. Now, if we look at the policies that enabled that, they were a strong role for government. Right? They were government paying for the cost of college so that anybody who wanted one, with some caveats that I'll come back to, could go to public college and state schools and graduate, with the government pretty much playing the full freight between the GI Bill and robust state funding for colleges. There were things like subsidized housing and really, really regulated corporate sector, high levels of union density enabled by, you know, real robust enforcement of labor laws. So this whole package had an asterisk, and the asterisk was that it was largely for whites only. And I talk about that in the book. I sort of run through the litany of what is known as free stuff that the government used to basically hand out, not out of a sense of charity to its white citizens, but out of a sense that it was a good investment. And in turn, white Americans in the 1930s, 40s, and 50s particularly loved the government and loved unions. In 1960, two-thirds of white Americans thought that the government ought to guarantee a job to everyone who wanted one and guarantee a minimum level of income in the country. Now, I've worked my whole career in the shadow, in many ways, of what the white kind of median moderate will and won't think is too radical. Now, those are some really radical ideas that used to be overwhelmingly popular with white people. And between 1960 and 1964, support for that idea among white people got slashed in half and has stayed low ever since. And so I looked at that number in my spreadsheets and I said, what is going on here? You do not see that kind of a dramatic shift in data between, you know, in a four-year period. And I thought, okay, so what happened? Well, 1963, the March on Washington, the demands included those kinds of economic guarantees, but they were obviously suggesting that they should be for Black people too. President Kennedy really became associated with civil rights. It became clear to the white majority that suddenly the people that they had been taught for generations to disdain and distrust were going to be included in the circle of human concern, in the circle of beneficiaries of collective bargaining, right? Unions began to open their doors and the government. And so in large numbers, white Americans turned their backs on those institutions. Now, of course, the ancillary cost was they then had given political cover to a movement that would only get stronger and stronger, that was consolidating corporate power to attack government, attack tax revenue, attack unions. And here we are left with the inequality era.
And where the economic benefit of the racial bargain for whites, as you write, shrank more and more for all but the richest. You know, another thing that struck me that you don't say in your book, but really comes home to me, and I've always thought about, is that when you were talking about the leadership of movements that began to build a multiracial coalition, and that is Martin Luther King, that is Malcolm X, that is Fred Hampton in Chicago, they were all assassinated exactly upon the point where they were building that multiracial coalition.
Yeah, there is definitely a degree to which the most frightening thing to the white power structure and the white economic elite is cross-racial solidarity. I mention it briefly in this book, but I have a whole essay about it in the book, 400 Souls, A Community History of African America, which is edited by Ibram Kendi and Kendra Blaine. It's actually debuted on the number one on the New York Times bestseller list this week, which I'm just still agog at because it's an anthology about history, but it's so exciting. Such kudos to those editors for putting together this amazing book. But my little chapter in it is about an historical moment called Bacon's Rebellion, which many historians see as the first American Revolution, and it was an uprising against the colonial government of Virginia by landless white people and indentured servants and African slaves. And in response to that cross-racial organizing, it was when we first began to see, right at the turn of the 18th century, laws to really create a hierarchy based on skin color in order to divide the white and black working class in order to make sure that white people felt, white-skinned people, I mean, this was really at the beginning of even thinking about race in the way that we do now. In fact, the colonial government called them Christians versus non-Christians, right? But that white-skinned people would feel an allegiance to the white upper class and not to their brethren in, you know, the same class structure. And that really is where we get the racial hierarchy that we have today. Greed has always been the driver and racism has been the tool.
And is that what's behind the use of the term racial capitalism?
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, like any use of the word capitalism, I think there's so much that is, you know, thrown into it, right? We talk about capitalism and what we really mean is, you know, exploitative capitalism. Sometimes we really do mean the, you know, private ownership of all, you know, means of production and, you know, all of this, right? But basically, there's now a great amount of economic history to really show that slavery and the theft, not only of a people, but of land in the United States created our capitalism, and that you can't disentangle the formation of American capitalism from the racist logic of our major wealth producing public policies, which were stolen land and stolen labor. And a lot of much smarter people than I have written throughout history about the ways in which marketing whiteness to people who were at the bottom of an economic caste system enabled the perpetuation of that caste system, because you could say, hey, you're not just poor, you're white. And so here are all of these social benefits that are maybe not even so great, but compared to the abject slavery and discrimination and, you know, torture with impunity and rape and all of that, that was the rightslessness of being Black in America, sure, you'll take your poverty minimum wage because that is better than working for nothing. Sure, you'll take, you know, not having a voice on the job and real power because you've got what W.B. Du Bois, the great Black historian, called the wages of whiteness, which were not material wages, but psychological wages.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Heather McGee about her new book, The Sum of Us, What Racism Costs Everyone and How We Can Prosper Together. You know, I'd known for a long time that you were writing this book. It was on my radar screen. But the whole point that you're making here really propelled me forward to want to read this book and talk with you about it. When I attended a Zoom training on something called the race class narrative, tell us about the race class narrative, how it brings these two points together to try to begin to move the needle on building a multiracial working class movement.
So this was a project that I brought to Demos, the think tank where I was president for 4 years and I worked for nearly two decades, in partnership with my mentor from law school, Ian Haney Lopez, a great, great writer, and Anant Shankar Osorio, who's a communications expert. And it was really trying to bridge the race left and the class left, as Ian so often says and wrote about in his recent book called Merge Left. And what we found in a ton of focus groups and testing and community conversations and advocate interviews was that the generic colorblind economic populist message, right, the 99%, the corporate elite, et cetera, works up to a point. And that point is when it comes up against the zero-sum racial scapegoating message about criminal immigrants and inner city thugs and really pointing the blame for what most Americans know are the basic problems in their lives. Either you blame the 1% or you blame people of color. That's kind of, you know, the options that politics offers you. And if the left message doesn't say anything about race, it leaves in the white imagination, but in the imagination of some people of color too, particularly Latinos who are not necessarily firmly in the people of color camp yet in our history, it leaves the space to be filled in with the more explicit racial narrative that you hear. And so what we discovered was that what worked even better than the kind of colorblind economic populist narrative was one in which you call out the zero sum, you call out the scapegoating, and you say that these politicians who are rigging the rules to line their own pockets are pointing their fingers at Black people and brown people and struggling families. And that lifting the curtain of the other side's strategy is really empowering to the listener, because they can then take that new way of seeing the world out with them into, frankly, a world that is much more populated by the right-wing message than is the left-wing message.
And okay, so I'm going to come back to the race class narrative at the end, because I would like to talk about, you know, how people can get involved with it or learn more about it if they want to do this, because this is something that is being used by various groups that are organizing voters as well as communities. Is that right? But before we do that, Heather McGee, let's go back to this book, The Sum of Us, and how you break down some of the ways in which racism has been used to impoverish most of all of us. And talk about public goods, you know, and let's start with pools. I mean, this was such an amazing part of the book. You know, you mentioned education before. You know, my mother went to college for free and I went to college for practically nothing in the 1960s. Now, you know, I don't even know if my granddaughter will be able to afford college. But public pools is such a small but perfect example. Talk about that.
So in the early part of the 20th century, the United States went on a building boom of pools, swimming pools, but not just any pool. These were grand resort style pools that could hold hundreds, even thousands of swimmers at a time. And it was really part of this sort of Americanizing project, you know, to cohere a sense of social identity among a rapidly diversifying in terms of European immigrant nation, and also this sort of symbol of this newfound commitment in the New Deal era of government to a higher quality of life of its citizens. And like so much of the New Deal and like so much of government at this time, many communities segregated their pools. They were for whites only. And so when in the 1950s and 60s, the civil rights movement empowered Black Americans to say, our tax dollars are funding the creation and maintenance of these pools, you can't keep us out, and courts began to side with them, what did towns do? Did they just go ahead and put aside their racial biases and realize that Black skin does not in fact wash off and infect you in the water? No. So many towns across the country, Mississippi, Louisiana, Ohio, Washington State, West Virginia, drained their public pools rather than integrate them. They backed trucks of dirt into them, paved them over, seeded them with grass that was green by the time the next summer came along. And of course, this was something that meant that the entire community lost out, that white people lost a public resource they had enjoyed, that it became privatized. So that then you start to see the advent of the backyard swimming pool and the members-only swim clubs. And I just felt like this was such a perfect metaphor for what happened to the country during the crisis of inclusion, during the civil rights movement, when you began to see white Americans faced with the choice of sharing the country with the people they'd been taught to distrust and disdain, and instead saying, well, we just won't have any at all, and we will go it on our own. And I don't think that white Americans knew sort of just what was coming in terms of the huge economic dislocations and disruptions. I think part of the sort of hubris that allowed, you know, white everyday Americans and white economic elites to think, okay, we don't need government anymore. We don't need to share these things, was exactly that the formula had worked so well and there was so much wealth and prosperity, but it had been really seeded by government policy and government largesse. And so you then have a sharp rightward shift among the white population, propping up really right-wing ideas around markets and getting government out the way, attacks on unions, all of these things that represent collective action, government and labor unions. And so what happens is you start to see the growth of the inequality era and working and middle class white people falling further and further behind. As you mentioned, I like to use the example of college. A lot of people like to use the example of welfare, right? The idea that, oh, why are these white people voting who are poor in Kentucky and, you know, all of these places where there's so much poverty and dependence on welfare benefits, and yet there's such a sort of right-wing narrative. I think that's an important piece of the puzzle for sure, what has happened to our poverty policies because of the racialization of poverty, which is inaccurate. But I also think it's important not to let middle and upper class people off the hook in terms of what costs they are shouldering for their social liberalism and fiscal conservatism, right? Which is just, you know, to me, one of those nice ways of talking about a fundamentally self-sabotaging and immoral approach that's ahistorical. You can't be fiscally conservative if that means that you are unwilling to invest in the basic things that make a society flourish. As I said, it's I think it's self-sabotaging at best and immoral at worst.
And you mentioned unions. You talk about two union organizing, two worker organizing drives. One is one in Mississippi, the Nissan plant in 2017. I mean, an organizing drive that actually failed on racism. And you contrast that with the Fight for 15, where a cross-racial solidarity was actually the point. Tell us what happened in the first one and how do we get to the second one on a more broad basis?
So I think that the question of whether or not we can recommit to the most successful formula for ensuring that workers can take home a decent slice of the pie they spend all day baking, which is collective bargaining, really has come down to race. There is a 20 to 30 percentage point gap between support for unions among white versus black and brown people, which is somewhat ironic given the fact that unions, you know, if you talk to older black folks, they'll say unions are for white people, right? The union folks kept us out, you know, with bat and fist, right? Unions were clubs, really, that were allowed to be by AFL rule discriminatory, and employers loved to exploit the fact that so much racism within union ranks meant that Black people were often left out of unions so they could be brought in as strike breakers and they could be used as a cudgel to threaten unions and say, well, you know, if you guys don't want to play, we've always got these other workers out here, right? It's this zero sum, which is enabled by exclusion, right? Exclusion leaves people out of the pool that can then be exploited by the boss. And so really this history of collective bargaining is so deeply intertwined with race and racism. And so I traveled to Canton, Mississippi in the wake of a failed organizing drive for a Nissan car factory. And I talked to workers there who were very clear that the reason why most white workers voted against the union, despite the promise of higher wages and better benefits, was, as one worker, Joey, said, you know, the whites aren't voting yes if the blacks are for it, right? If the blacks are for it, then we're against it. And it was, you know, both shocking and also familiar. And I was surprised in my travels in Mississippi, because I went down there thinking it would be so obvious that collective bargaining would be in the best interest and self-interest of white workers, right? I'm from the Midwest. I knew that factory workers in the South were getting a raw deal compared to those in the Midwest. But after the first day, when I heard all the workers talking about how there was a sort of invisible ladder of hierarchy in the plant, and that white workers really were more likely to get the what they called the cushier jobs, right? The less labor intensive, less backbreaking jobs. In the words of one of the workers, such a beautiful illustration, these jobs are so cush that you can go straight from work to the happy hour. You don't have to go home and shower first, right? So I was like, well, wait a second. So if white workers are really getting this sort of leg up, right, they're more likely to get these higher paying, less difficult jobs in the plant, maybe they're right not to want a union. Because as one of the workers said, you know, the union is all about fairness and equality and putting everyone on the same plane and making everyone subject to the same rules about promotions and et cetera. And then I had to sort of shake myself and realize, no, that's exactly the way the racist logic works. It's not that there aren't privileges of being white. It's that they are, A, the kinds of, you know, privileges that everybody should have, and B, they are still in a system where most people don't have enough. And even the guys in the cushier part of the factory floor didn't have reliable healthcare or a real pension or higher pay.
And so why was the fight for $15 an hour, which was, after all, a non-union workforce, able to be so unbelievably successful by building cross-racial solidarity?
I think the fight for 15 in a union was successful in terms of being able to win in dozens of cities, you know, $15 an hour raises that were unthinkable. This is going from $7.25 in many places. And in lots of private companies, federal contractors, McDonald's, Walmart, Amazon, right? I mean, this is really successful in terms of worker organizing, because at its heart, it was able to be a cross-racial movement. And the workers I spoke to and the organizers I spoke to were very explicit in really using the concepts behind the race class narrative, the idea that you really have to call out racism as an enemy to all workers and be explicit about forging a sort of cross-racial working class identity. I talked to this one woman, a white woman named Bridget in Kansas City, who had been a fast food worker for over a decade. And she had really been sold this zero-sum idea. She said, you know, I'd been fed this whole line of immigrant workers are coming over here and stealing our jobs, you know, us against them. But soon after she began organizing, she really had a eureka moment when she saw herself in a Latina mother of three like herself. And she said, you know, in order for us to come up, it's not a matter of me coming up and them staying down. In order for me to come up, they have to come up too. Because honestly, as long as we're divided, we're conquered.
Heather McGee, in this book, The Sum of Us, you contrast the zero-sum narrative with the idea of the solidarity dividend. Tell us, what is a solidarity dividend, and give us some examples.
So I think that we have to really start searching for solidarity dividends everywhere. I began to see them kind of everywhere I turn. Just this idea that In fact, it could be pretty simple. If enough white Americans put aside the zero-sum narrative and recognize their common problems with working and middle-class people of color, we could create a durable multiracial coalition to unlock what I began to call these solidarity dividends. And I mean things like higher wages, as the Fight for 15 was able to. I visit with a community in Richmond, California that created a multiracial coalition that took on a huge polluter in their community. And so they were able to unlock the solidarity dividend of cleaner air. There was a dying mill town in Maine that was able to attract new Mainers, as they called them, in the form of refugees and immigrants, mostly from Africa, mostly Muslim, and able to create enough at the grassroots level, although the politics in the community were very anti-immigrant and caustic. But at the grassroots level, they were able to create enough sense of shared purpose that it really helped revive this dying small town. And so in some ways, as an economic policy person, you can let things get very complex. And yet, I think that most of the nice things that most people want, to know that they'll always have a roof over their head, to know that they can balance work and family, to have the ability to see a doctor without going bankrupt, to have the ability to drink clean water and breathe clean air, to feel like the biggest problems that face our society are being taken care of in a very functional way. Well-funded schools in every neighborhood. These things that I think shouldn't be out of our reach, but should be the basics, the minimum for a country with our wealth. I think we can achieve those pretty easily if we stop letting ourselves be divided by a pretty narrow, self-interested elite that uses racial scapegoating in order to create division to prop up the economic status quo.
And so, for those in our listening audience who would like to know more about the race class narrative, can you give us some pointers?
Sure. Well, thankfully, there's a bunch of stuff online about this. Ian Haney Lopez has something called the Race Class Academy up online that you can Google. We had a video series that we did with Inequality Media and MoveOn.org. Obviously, you can get the book, and that gives a more comprehensive view. I talk about issues like climate change, the chapter on the financial crisis, the chapter on democracy. And ultimately what we have to do is we have to get involved and we have to organize. And if you're not in an organization or an effort that puts you in regular contact with people outside of your own cultural background, then do so. Because once you do, I really do think the world opens up in a really beautiful way.
Well, on that hopeful note, I want to thank you, Heather McGee, so much for talking with us here about this important book and terrific read, The Sum of Us.
Thank you so much.
Heather McGee is the former president of the think tank Demos and now chairs the board of Color of Change, the nation's largest online racial justice organization. Go to writersvoice.net for links to resources about the race class narrative, as well as to read an excerpt from Heather McGee's book. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Do you know you can go to writersvoice.net to sign up for our podcast and weekly newsletter? Find extra content there with links, book excerpts, and extended interviews. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.